Com. Greetings from BBS Radio, where truth and news still exist in that original form. You're tuned in to The Spiritual Politician, the show that shows you where politics, government, and that nasty selfishness went wrong, and how you can take action to make it right. I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster, your host for this hour of insight aimed at making each of us more responsible, more cooperative, and more aware of the spiritual bonds that connect us to each other, no matter what we find to quibble or squabble over in the interim. Now, you can call us toll-free from the U.S. to 877-876-5227. You can call from Canada to 888-810-8322. Or you can call direct to 530-876-3222. This show is carried online, and you may also be able to get it on the air in your local area. To find out if one of those old-fashioned 20th century on-the-air stations in your area carries this show, you just contact us at bbsradio.com. The website for the show can be found on the BBS Radio site and at spiritualpolitician.blogspot.com. All past shows become available as soon as it is humanly or extra-humanly possible on the station archives. As the week just passed leads into Father's Day, I suggest all of us take a moment and consider fathers and fatherhood. I had a great father, a good man who was an example to follow, and I have done just that all of my life, but not everyone is so fortunate. One of our guests last week was Colonel David Antoon, and he wrote a short article for Father's Day, and I'm going to read it to you, just in case you did not find it in your local paper or online. And he's titled it, Thanking Muhammad Ali for His Moral Courage. I never had expected to have the opportunity to thank Muhammad Ali, but as I was preparing to pilot a 747 en route to Singapore, I heard he was on board. Ali was traveling with his entourage to represent New York in their bid for the Olympics in 2005. The year before, it had been Ali's courage upon which I reflected as I was forced to confront the issue of where fatherhood transcends nationalism. Saying thank you to Muhammad Ali was little enough. Professor Andrew Bekovich, a West Point graduate and Vietnam veteran whose son was killed in Iraq on Mother's Day, has written extensively about poisonous U.S. foreign policy. That was true in Vietnam, is true today in Iraq. Ali's example reaffirmed my decision to speak the truth, a truth that altered my son's life dreams and translated my private concerns into action. In the spring of 2004, after an exemplary academic and athletic career, my son received a coveted appointment to the Air Force Academy, a stop in his lifelong goal to be just like his father. Ryan is a son to make any father proud, but never more than when out of deep conscience and great moral courage, he turned down his appointment to my alma mater. The son of a career military man myself, I had followed my own father's example. Fathers and the choices we make as fathers matter. In 1960, Ali had won the Olympic gold medal in the light heavyweight division, crushing all opposition. In 1964, he won the heavyweight championship. In 1967, Ali refused induction into the Army, arguing that the Vietnam War violated his conscience. Ali, arguably the greatest boxer to ever enter the ring, is today fighting Parkinson's disease. My time in the Air Force Academy, 1966 to 1970, had coincided with Ali's refusal to be inducted into the military. Ali served prison time because of an issue of conscience. Our government had wanted Ali not as a soldier, but to bring in recruits. Instead, his fight raised the consciousness about what was really happening in Vietnam. One of my last assignments before retirement in 1990 was Project Oversight, part of the production of the B-2 bomber. That assignment raised my consciousness. The world then and now looks very different to me. The B-2 explained to me how the corporate world allied with government works. I went down to first class to find the man who danced like a butterfly and stung like a bee. Ollie is still a big man, dwarfing those around him. I knelt so I could look him right in the eye, and I told him I consider him a hero, not for his world championship title fights, but for having the moral courage to refuse induction into the Army during Vietnam. Ollie's hand shook with the tremors of Parkinson's as he extended it to me. He nodded. Ollie has a hard time speaking now, but I could see he was moved by what I had told him. His battle of conscience has ended. For many of us, those battles are still to come. My questions began in earnest during the build-up to the war in Iraq. I began to speak out. When I graduated from the Air Force Academy, I did not question orders. During my three tours in Vietnam, I saw horror and suffering. Then I chose to believe that our presence there was necessary for America's national interest. I was wrong, and today I can confront that. It did not come on me in one day, but over a period of years. It was the process of a gut-wrenching look at U.S. military operations during my lifetime. I was in the Philippines for a jungle survival training in 1974 when I bumped into Captain Don Dawson, a B-52 pilot, on my way to the officers' club. Don and I had been in the same squadron at the academy. Don was always one of the good guys, quiet, laid back, and unflappable. Don had been at Clark Air Force Base for nearly a year under house arrest at that point because he was refusing to continue to do carpet bombing missions into Cambodia. "I can't do this anymore," was what he told his commander, and that he told me. He was put under house arrest, awaiting court-martial, for refusing to participate. For Don, the final straw had been the annihilation of an entire wedding party. Today, Don defends capital cases in Tennessee after conviction. Don's courage cost him his marriage and his career, but not his conscience. A clean conscience matters. Doing the right thing matters. The courage of others who speak out and refuse to participate arms us to do right. As a father, I realized that the truth, all of the truth, was something I owed my son. If a child cannot trust his father or mother for honesty and integrity, then who can they trust? I attended the Air Force Academy 04 orientation with my son, a visceral event causing my catharsis. Leadership had been replaced with warriorship. Secular spiritual inclusion had been replaced with dominist evangelism. Reports of Abu Ghraib, torture, rendition, secret gulag prisons hidden around the world, depleted uranium, aerial bombing of urban areas with napalm and more, war surfacing. Iraq, deja vu, Vietnam. I realized I had been less than forthcoming with my own son. Ryan had no idea what Vietnam and Iraq were really about or what he would be expected to do if he joined. That night we talked late. Ryan's only ambition had been to attend the academy and fly Air Force fighters. During those long hours, Ryan asked searching questions, transforming both of us through a dialogue on conscience and moral courage that still continues. That autumn, Ryan began his freshman year in Ohio State University. Today, he's a different man, a man who sees further and deeper than I did at his age. No one could have a better gift on Father's Day than seeing a child confront an unpalatable truth and choose right. The common thread of Muhammad Ali's decision to refuse induction, of Don Dawson's refusal to continue carpet bombing on non-military civilians, and even of Ryan's decision to decline his coveted appointment to the academy during periods of faux nationalism is moral courage. A recent endorsement to my son by Pulitzer Prize-winning author Chris Hedges spoke of moral courage and the necessity to always keep questioning authority. Never take for granted what you're told by those in authority. Your integrity is your most precious asset. Every father should speak these words to his children. There can be no greater gift for a father than to know he has instilled in his children these values. And that's our thought for Father's Day. And now our thought for the week ahead. We throw around the words freedom, justice, honor, courage every day, but between the words and the choices we make, there's a lot of living. In the Declaration of Independence, it says, and this is solid gold true, All experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. That means we will put up with a lot. But the time comes when something happens and we realize that the whole system is seriously broken. For many people, that comes when they get a ticket they know perfectly well that they did not deserve. You can beat those traffic tickets and get the tools you need to arm yourself against the powers that be. If you don't, you will soon wish you had. The problems are not going away. They're only getting worse, and I think that we all see that today. Our guest tonight will be talking about his website and how it works to give you some tools for self-defense, for simple things and not so simple things. The Ticket Slayer, Greg Slaughter, takes you through all the issues from those tickets that can cost you a whole house payment today to what to do when the cop who pulls you over smashes your cell phone or camera, something happening all too often in this day and age. Many people who were raised in an era when Blackwater was not training our local police are learning from experience just how expensive it is not to know. It all gets down to the fact that it is you who are sovereign, not the government or those working for the government, not the president, not senators or congressmen, your governor, mayor, or that local cop. It's you, the people. Your rights come with you at birth. They're not a gift from government. That's not where they come from. You need to know that. You need to get the corollaries. And you, too, can be armed with the truth and ready to fight, not only for your freedom, but for everyone else's. And it's my delight to welcome Greg Slaughter. Greg, are you there?
I am here.
Well, thank you so much for being with us this afternoon.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
And we always start by asking our guests to tell us something about themselves so we can just find out who you are. So, tell us about Greg.
Well, I don't know there's a lot to tell about Greg. I'm a pretty ordinary fellow. I've been married for 35 years to a wonderful woman who's managed to put up with me. And I have four children, all pretty much grown now. I have my youngest that's still at home going to college, and she's 19, almost 20. But as far as my adult working life, I spent 21 years as a railroad engineer. And as I told you, Melinda, when we were speaking the other day, I left there because of the situation that the railroad refused to address, which was sleep deprivation. That's a taboo they don't want to talk about.
Why don't you tell people about that a little bit? Because that's a really interesting story. And, we all live in this illusion that, when you take a train or a plane, the first thing that they think about is whether or not, the people who are going to be operating it are, can safely do so.
Sure. I can't speak to airline pilots authoritatively, but I'm sure that they suffer from the same things I suffered through, or some of the same things I suffered through related to sleep when I was on the railroad. Airline pilots do have a schedule. I was in freight service for the railroad, and there was no schedule. It was all call. And, for instance, you could get a call in the middle of the night. It might be, midnight. It might be 2 a.m., 4 a.m., or dawn, crack of dawn when the phone rings, and you have to be ready to go to work. Once you find yourself at work, you get to the other terminal where you would lay over, and then you wait to be called out from that terminal. And, of course, there's no schedule. You don't know when you might get called out. There's little way to know when you might expect to get called. So you never know how to get your rest. So you could lay at your way from home terminal for as little as 8 hours, and as much as I've done it, as much as 2 days. So how do you know when you're going to get called out?
And it's hard to make sure that you're rested.
Yes, you can't plan your rest.
Unless, of course, you stay in bed all the time.
And then, of course, when you have your circadian rhythms are completely thrown off because you have no pattern of rest, and so it's just helter-skelter completely. So what I began to suffer from was sleep deprivation. And, of course, another problem was at the same time I was bombarded by terrible noise. It was like being in a battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't realize at the time that I was suffering from pretty much what soldiers suffer from on the battlefield. It's just the battlefield noise, or shell shock, as they commonly call it. And so I had these two terrible things going at one time, and I was a pretty hard guy to live with. I don't know how my wife put up with me and my family, my kids. And it was completely just destroying my life. And again, this is something the railroad doesn't want to talk about. I'm not the only one that suffered from it. Thousands of train employees do.
Now, one of the things that you mentioned before that I think is very relevant here is that what they're trying to do, what they do, is they take the potential liability and they get their employee to bear that entirely. So corporately, they aren't accountable if there is an accident when they have created the circumstances that create the accident.
That's very true. This happened towards the end of my career before I left, is that probably for the last 4 or 5 years, they made the shift. They changed the law that regulated railroad liability, and they shifted it from the railroad to the employee. And, of course, we had tremendous pressure put on us to do certain things, and so kind of a wink and nod that, you know, don't worry about that. Just get the job done. You know, even the rules tell you to do this. The government regulations tell you to do this. You know, you better get the job done because that's what we need you to do. And, of course, that created a lot of pressure, too. And so they shifted the fines that the railroads used to be hit with or levied with for violations of certain requirements regarding railroads. It might be the equipment violations for engines and rolling stock, or the track violations, anything to do with the regulatory nature. They shifted the liability from that and put it squarely on the employees.
Well, that's certainly an interesting thing to be able for them to be able to do.
And the fines were just laughable.
But of course, you didn't get the profits naturally. This didn't go along with any sort of profit sharing.
No, during that period, they had cut our throats on contracts.
Now, what period is this? Can you give us a date?
This happened primarily in the late 80s and early 90s. That a lot of this I'm talking about took place as far as the regulation of the railroads.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, we can get that opens up a whole bunch of different things. But let's get on with the tickets now, because but let's remember that, because that could be a whole another thing for us to talk about, because that's something people need to know about, that hooks us over, surprise, surprise, into policy decisions made way back in the mid-70s and things set in motion then.
Of course.
So tell us about tickets and how you decided that this was a problem and you were going to do something about it and train people in the common law.
Sure. Well, I started with a ticket that my wife had received. She was cited for speeding in a construction zone. The problem with it is that the construction zone was not set up correctly. The signs for the construction zone, people weren't properly noticed by the signage. And the other problem was they failed to get a permit, as they're required under law to do, to invoke a construction zone in that area. That what they created was a speed trap, and the police knew that it was all illegal, but they didn't care. They wrote 263 tickets in about a 3 to 4 day period. So.
Okay, let's take a look at this second, how much income that was going to generate for this town.
Well, I haven't added it up particularly, but I can tell you that the tickets at the time, as I recall, I believe the speed limit was normally 45, and they had reduced it down to 25 for the construction zone. So in most states, in the state I'm in California, the fines double in a construction zone for speeding or other violations. And so the fine, I believe, at that time was probably $180 for doing 45 in a 25. So if you double that, that's 360.
Mm-hmm.
And
so that's a pretty big amount of money.
Yeah, I say there's 263 tickets written in that 4 or 5 day or 3 or 4 day period there. And I can't do the math that quickly, but that was a substantial amount of money.
So it was about 180.
Pardon?
It's about $180 each.
Well, actually, the most of them are probably written for double 300. $360.
Wow.
But anyway, what happened in this case? It really lit my fire, I guess, so to speak. My wife, when she got the ticket, she told the officer she didn't think that the signs for the construction zone were properly placed. They were just haphazardly thrown up, and they weren't properly posted. So we did a little investigating, and we went down to the DMV and got the vehicle codes and the book on the vehicle code. And I think it cost us a whole $3. And it didn't take us long to discover, the signage had to be a certain way. And it was a divided road with a 45-mile-an-hour speed limit. So it required them to start 1,500 feet in advance of the construction zone and place a sign every 500 feet saying construction zone ahead. And it had to be posted on both sides of the road for the direction of travel, and which it wasn't. They just had a little, they only posted it one place and one time on a little sawhorse that, like a construction sawhorse you see at these sites. It had a sign tacked on it, construction zone, for, 25 miles per hour.
Mm-hmm.
And she missed that sign because she was in the number one lane or the one towards the center island, and there was a dump truck up next to her when she came up to that intersection and completely obscured her.
Mm-hmm.
The thing from her sight. But she even told a cop that.
Well, he didn't care because what they were doing was augmenting income.
Well, yeah, their job was to gather revenue. He did say, well, okay, I'll tell you, I'll just be a good guy and I'll just write you for speeding and not speeding in construction zone. Wow, how nice of him. And,
yeah, real sport.
Pardon?
He's a real sport.
Real sport. And so, anyway, when I kind of got involved in this and we looked up the regulations, found that they were totally in violation of them. Then I decided to make the sergeant that was out there at the site, I wanted to make this information known to him and tell him that he should tear up this ticket. It was all wrong. There were 6 police out there writing tickets, 4 motorcycle cops and 2 in squad cars, and they had a sergeant out there, and he told me he had 19 years' experience on the force, and he told me that all that was perfectly legal that they'd set up there. And he didn't care that I was explaining to him that the vehicle code said it wasn't. And he said, well, I was told to come out here and do this, and this is what I'm going to do.
That's my job. I'm only following orders.
I'm only following orders. So I called his lieutenant, who was in charge of traffic for the police department, and I told him the same thing. And my wife did. I was standing next to her, and because she had the ticket, I wanted her to talk to him. And I could kind of hear, standing closely to the phone, what he was saying, and he was a very condescending tone to her that, I've got a sergeant out there with 19 years' experience. If there's anything wrong, he would know it. And she explained to him, well, I've already talked to your sergeant, and he does now know it, but he doesn't care. And she told him, I want you to come out here, and I want you to look at this. And he very reluctantly agreed, or said he would. And he called her back about 20 minutes later and said he went out there and looked at it, and everything was perfectly fine.
And so what happened? You went through this process with your wife.
Right.
And you found out a couple kind of surprising things.
Well, what happened at that point, I happen to recall that a previous neighbor of ours, where we used to live in a different part of town, is the city traffic engineer, the chief city traffic engineer. And his kids and my kids played together growing up in the neighborhood, and, you know, I knew him. And so I decided to make a call to him to see what he could tell me about this so-called construction zone. So I called him up. His name is Steve. And I said, Steve, just wanted to call you and talk to you about this construction zone over here by the golf course near the high school in River Lakes. And he says to me, what construction zone? And I said, well, the construction zone they got over here, you know, by the high school and the golf course here at River Lakes. And he says, there's no construction zone there. I thought he was, you know, being cute with me or toying with me a little bit. I said, Steve, you're not listening to me. I said, my wife got a ticket in this construction zone over here. And he says, well, you don't understand. There is no construction zone over there because I signed the permits. And I said, wow, okay, now I understand.
Did anybody ever actually see any work being done there?
I'm sorry?
Did anybody actually see any work being done there?
There was some work going on. What I was told later that happened was that they were widening the road there. They're putting in some more lanes, and they had this been going on for about a year. We lived near the area, and the road widening thing didn't seem to be progressing in any big hurry. But as the golf course neared completion, they decided they need to get this done. So they put a lot of people out there, crews out there working on this road. And I understand one of the workers almost got hit by a car, a passing car, because he stepped out into the traffic lane. His own fault. And so the contractor complained to the police, and the police says, well, just put up this, you know, sign and say construction zone, we'll come out here and enforce it. And that's what he did, and that's what happened. And the police knew it was supposed to be permitted. The contractor knew it was supposed to be permitted, and nobody cared. So after I found that out, after my friend Steve told me that that he signed the permits as the chief traffic engineer, and it wasn't a construction zone unless he did sign a permit, that's what all I needed to hear, really. I asked him to please, I had a fax in my home, I said, please, if you don't mind, do me a small favor and just put a note on your official city stationery, under your signature, saying that you did not permit this so-called construction zone, and send it over to me, and he did. When I got it, I got on the phone to the police chief, and I told him the whole story. I told him how, you know, my wife in the very beginning told him that the construction zone was improper or bogus, and how she talked to the cops and nobody cared, and how that she even talked to the sergeant and the lieutenant in charge of traffic, and he didn't care. They just wanted to write traffic tickets. And then I asked the police chief if he had a fax machine nearby, and he says, well, I got one right here in my office. And I said, could I get your fax number, please? And he gave it to me, and I said, I'm sending something right over to you, and I want you to read it to me when you get it. So he came right over, heard the phone ring, and he picked it up, and he starts reading the note from my friend Steve, and he says, oh, I think we have a problem here. And I said, you're darn right you got a problem. I said, your cops are out there writing tickets on a bogus construction zone. And they know it, and they don't care. And, you know, you got six cops out there writing them by the handfuls. And he said, well, you know, Mr. Slaughter, what would you like me to do? And which I thought was a real dumb question. And I said, well, obviously, I said, I think you know the right thing to do or what you should do. And but if you need me to tell you, I will. I said, you're going to rescind the traffic ticket my wife got, and you're going to rescind all those tickets that have been handed out. And I had no idea how many at the time had been handed out. I found out later.
And how many was it?
263.
That's a huge amount of money.
That's a huge amount of money.
That so they had brought in. And, they had six cops over there writing the tickets. They obviously had the whole thing planned.
That's right.
It makes you wonder what they figured they had to pay for.
Well, it was gold-plated, I'm sure.
Yes.
And so anyway, what happened from this point on, the police chief promised me that he would rescind my, I did tell him this before ended the conversation. I told him that, you know, I was inclined to go to the media over this, but I didn't really want to because I knew how dirty the cops could be, and I told him that quite frankly and straight out. And he says, well, I'm sorry you feel that way. And I said, I got good cause to. And anyway, so he promised to rescind those tickets. And the next day in the mail, my wife got a letter from the police department rescinding her ticket. And some of my neighbors I knew had gotten those tickets, and some other people I knew through the high school there with my daughter that didn't live in the neighborhood had also got tickets because they were traveling through the area. And as far as I could determine, all the tickets got rescinded.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was one little point I left out there along that way.
And this is actually what interesting you in the,
yeah, this,
in the whole process.
This is what really just kind of lit my fire on this whole thing, because I realized how corrupt the whole thing was. They were breaking the law, and they flat out didn't care.
Yeah, and one of the things that then you actually had another little sort of an outcome of this. They started following your wife around.
Yeah,
right?
There was another part to that story too that I failed to mention, is that when my wife complained about the signs not being properly displayed, the next day in the mail she got an amended ticket from this officer, amending the ticket to speeding in the construction zone. So in retaliation for her complaining, he retaliated by amending the ticket. And that was another thing I brought up with the chief. But so they were, they already showed a pattern of retaliation.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, I guess it was three or four days later, my wife comes home from lunch and she says, you know, the cops are following me around. And I said, well, okay, are you sure? Or are you just, maybe a little paranoid? And she says, oh, no, I'm sure now. I thought I might be a little paranoid in the beginning. I would leave the house to go to work, and I'd go a few blocks. The next thing you know, I'd have a cop following me. And he would follow me for several blocks and then turn off on a side street somewhere. And then I'd go, a little ways, four or five more blocks. And next thing I know, I got a cop turning off of a side street and coming in right behind me. And they would follow me all the way to work. And when I left for lunch, even to do errands on my lunch hour, I would have cops follow me. And they would follow me all the way home from work.
So it was just simple harassment.
Yeah, it was harassment. And so when I found that out, I made another phone call to the police chief. And I had told him at the end of our conversation that if there were any repercussions from this from the police, I would go to the media. And so I called up this chief, and I told him, I said, well, I guess you didn't take me seriously. And he says, well, I don't understand what you're talking about. And I said, well, your officers are following my wife around, and I'm not going to stand for it. I said, I don't care at this point. I will go to the media. I said, I've got enough dirt on you guys to make heads roll. And he says, well, Mr. Slaughter says, I didn't know this. I assure you that this will stop immediately. And I told him, I said, well, this is your very last chance, because it better. I won't tolerate this any further. And it did stop from that point.
Mm-hmm.
My wife and I had never been bothered since, so I don't know if we're on the do not stop list.
Oh, that you're on a list. But, that doesn't mean it isn't happening to other people as well.
Oh, sure.
So that's what's got you interested in the whole issue of the violations of going on systemically. And you started taking a look at it, and then you realized that these people sign an oath of office that, obligates them to follow the Constitution, and they don't do that.
Absolutely. Every day they violate their oath of office. Yes. excuse me. Well, you probably want to know how I got began with the common law default that I use in the traffic tickets. That's been so successful in getting traffic tickets.
Don't you tell us, give us an example of what somebody would do to get out of their ticket?
Okay.
How they would do it.
Oh, sure. It's I have a website. It's ticketslayer.com. And normally people find me by doing a search on the search engines, or looking for how to get out of a traffic ticket, or beat a red light camera ticket, or things like that. And a lot of the different Patriot groups have picked me up now, and I'm mentioned on their websites or in their blogs or different things like that, and they come to me that way too. But what I offer to them is a method to beat traffic tickets, and this method also works on other things besides traffic tickets, but that's primarily what I focus on. And it's called the common law default method. Before I get into that, if you don't mind, I'd like to give a little background why the common law default or the common law is so important.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. Most people, if you ask them about the common law, they really have no real idea about the common law or what it means. And that's understandable because the powers that be really don't want us to know. They want us to discover about the power of the common law. Because along with the Constitution and the common law, that is a duel that packs a lot of legal punch, that you can force these misbehaving people like judges or officers to behave themselves or else.
Mm-hmm.
And under Article 3 of the Constitution, the framers of the Constitution had set up the provisions for common law courts, and they also set up the provision for the Supreme Court, which was mandated to be a common law court. So the Supreme Court is a common law court, but it's not a trial court. The Supreme Court is a judicial review court, so it doesn't try cases; it just reviews cases that have been gone through the judicial system.
That's the final step in the appeal process.
That's right. So, but what we're missing is our common law courts, and we have no Article III courts. Now, the Congress and the judiciary in this country like to say that we do have common law courts, or Article III courts, but that's not truthful. Ed Rivera proved this. He did an intensive study about the history of the courts, and went in and researched the congressional archives, and the research into the Constitution about the Article III courts, and proved that no Article III court has been set up in the United States per the Constitution. First of all, they have to be standalone courts. They have to be designated as Article III courts. There's none of those. The other portion of this, and there's more, but these are the two important parts, is that the judge sitting on an Article III court bench cannot have his wages diminished, so he cannot be taxed. So that frees him from any influence of the government and the politicians.
Mm-hmm.
And then the important part of the common law itself, the common law was derived by a judicial decree over a long period of time, going back centuries. Now, when I say judicial decree, it's not as you might think today, where we have formalized courts and the type of courts we have today. Those were not the settings. In the very beginning, when people had a dispute, often that dispute was brought before a village elder or maybe a religious leader in the community.
Or whoever they appointed to be squire.
Yeah, whoever they appointed to be squire. Whoever they looked up to in the community, okay, and felt that they could render a just and fair verdict.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, these verdicts rendered by these judicial bodies were found to be fairly uniform because most of them were based upon Judeo-Christian principles in the Bible, so it was done through common sense. It was just logic, how things should be, plus using the moral guidance of the scriptures. And so, in time, these judicial decisions became known. The collection of them became known as the common law. And what makes this so important is that the common law was accepted by the common man. It was something that was worked through through a system of judicial review that he agreed with.
Mm-hmm.
and was a part of. And so the common law, it was just what it implies. It was a commonly accepted things that became law by judicial decree. And so this is how the framers of our Constitution mandated that us sovereign people be tried in a court. It had to be a common law procedure. And so, but as most people probably know listening to this broadcast, that we don't have common law courts, and they're not common law procedures. They are really more or less admiralty courts or courts of commerce.
Mm-hmm. Which, and, of course, is inappropriate.
Yeah, of course it is.
And it's not what's laid out in the Constitution.
That's right. They're courts of contract, and they're implied contracts, and the whole admiralty type of court is hidden from us. They won't admit to them, and they don't admit to their implied contracts, but that's what they do. So now the problem is how do you make them uphold the Constitution and give you your common law procedure, because that's important to the common law default that I use.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I should explain exactly what a common law default is. It's a very simple concept. Whenever someone under the common law makes a claim against another or against a person, that person the claim is made against has the legal right to make a counterclaim. And that claim is often put in a form of an affidavit and sworn to and signed by the person that's rebutting the charges of the party making the complaint.
Mm-hmm.
Once that challenge is made, the party that first brought the claim has an obligation under the law to rebut those claims made by the party he accused. And if he fails to do so under the common law, he loses all right to his claims.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the state is a legal person under the law. The state's a legal fiction, but it's also a person according to law. And the state must answer the common law default. And when they fail to do so, then under the common law, an unrebutted affidavit stands as truth. So all the counterclaims that we make, saying that I'm not that person, which they write your name in all caps, which indicates you're a legal fiction, and they also act on implied contracts, so we deny that we have a contract with the state, and we're not a party to the body politic, and we're the sovereign spoken of in the Iqlu versus Hopkins, where the Supreme Court clearly says that we are sovereign and not subject to the law. And the law that the Supreme Court's referring to is the law of legislature. Legislative law is inferior to the common law. Common law is superior. And so that's why common law is so important, because it is superior to the legislated law.
And that's the law that's controlled by the people directly.
That's the law controlled by the people. That's exactly right.
And what they want to do is a switch, doing it incrementally so that people have never really understood exactly what was happening.
Of course. That's
like,
how they...
It's like the frog in the hot water.
Doesn't realize when the heat's being turned up, does he?
That's right. And which is why, of course, he gets fried.
Right. Well, that's how they do it. They've been doing it to us for a long, long time, and they do it incrementally. And it was slowly over a period of time, so we, like the frog, we don't know we're being boiled alive.
Well, tell us about a case. So, you know, something kind of typical so people can get a sense of how that works when...
Okay, well, I'll tell you what. Let me go back and digress a little bit here to where I really started out here after I did start with the common law default. And I should say I learned this from a gentleman named of Clyde Hyde, who passed away a couple years ago. Clyde had a group on the internet where he taught people about the common law, which he learned from a retired judge, actually. So I don't think you'll find too many judges out there talking about the common law, but this was an exceptional one. And he taught Clyde about the power of the common law, and it's so important. And so in the beginning, I started out with my own son, who managed to get 5 traffic tickets in a year's period. Now, he sounds like a terrible driver, but he really isn't. He had had no tickets up to that time, and what had happened is this is in a period of time when California was going through its budgetary woes, and so the state started grabbing money from the local coffers of the cities and the counties and leaving them high and dry, so they had to scramble to find sources of revenue. Well, the easy one to do would be traffic. So they started writing traffic tickets like they were going out of style. And my son was driving a delivery vehicle at the time. And up to that time, the cops pretty much left the delivery drivers alone. They have to do some shortcuts to get around town and get things delivered. And they know that. And so they pretty much left them alone, didn't bother them. But they became fair game when they needed the revenue. So that's how I got 5 tickets in 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
And we got every ticket dismissed.
So tell us exactly how you did it.
Okay, so what we did, I took the information that I had learned from Clyde Hyde, that Clyde had actually created this whole common law default for traffic, and he had done it in the state of Washington. And when Clyde was alive, I contacted him and asked him if I could use his documents that he created and do this, offer it on the Internet to people. And so Clyde agreed, and that's how he started. But before I wanted to dare to get out onto the Internet and start offering this to people, I wanted to make sure it worked for myself or for someone at least I knew, like my son. And so when he got his first ticket, we went to court, and we filed the legal documents, the default. We filed the document that the prosecutor was required to rebut, and he failed to do so, and then we filed the other documents that legally cemented the default.
Mm-hmm. So abracadabra, it was gone.
Pardon?
And so what happened when you went into court?
Okay, by the time we got to court, all the documents had been filed, and the judge had copies of the documents, and we got to court early in the morning when he was supposed to be there, and it was packed. I mean, they had packed the house, and there was a crusty old judge sitting there, and he was just nailing people right and left. It didn't matter what defense they had, they went down in flames. And after a long time of this, of just people getting slammed, of course, other people started then seeing that they didn't stand a chance with this guy. He started saying, well, can I make a deal? So he let some of the, take off some of the fines and stuff and, reduce some of them. But, still they got cited or found guilty of some things. But this went on for a long time, and I got bored with the whole thing after a while, and I was kind of, my mind had wandered and wasn't paying any attention to what was really going on anymore. And all of a sudden, I'm kind of jolted back to reality, and it was by the judge had called my son's name, but it wasn't so much that got my attention. It was the chuckle in the judge's voice when he called his name that got my attention. And I didn't think the old guy could smile. I looked up, and he had this big old broad grin across his face. And my son stands up when he calls his name, and he says to my son, Mr. Slaughter, says, I got good news for you. He says, the cop couldn't be here today. I'm going to have to dismiss your case. And so the case got dismissed. Okay, now here's the thing. Clyde told me, he says, well, they'll never admit to the default. They'll always find an excuse to dismiss the case, and they'll never admit to the default. They'll usually say the officer couldn't be there.
Because that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, that's what happened. So, but I'm still not quite convinced. Was it just the luck of the draw? Did he get his case dismissed because the officer really couldn't be there? Or, did they use that just as an excuse? So it wasn't long. He got his second ticket, so he went back to court. Same judge, nailing people right and left. It's my son's turn. I'm sorry, Mr. Slaughter. The officer couldn't be here today. I got to dismiss. And he says it with a smile on his face again. And so for the third ticket, I had done some study, and I learned that he wasn't a judge. He was a commissioner, a traffic commissioner. And I learned that in California and most other states, you have the right to have your case heard by a judge. Both parties have to stipulate to a commissioner in California to hear the case. Well, there's no prosecutor used in traffic in most cases in California, so if the defendant doesn't stipulate, then they have to kick it up to a judge. So I told him, you go to court this time, and you tell the court commissioner that you want this case heard before a judge. And so he did, and the court commissioner says, well, okay, that's your right. And so he scheduled before a judge. Now, I know we don't have much time. We're running out of time here, about 9 minutes, it looks like.
Oh, well, we have to get off before then.
Okay. Well, I'll make this quick. So this is a funny story, though. He goes into court, and now it's up on the third floor, which normally traffic cases are down, third floor in traffic court. This is up into, you know, the court where they deal with felonies and, you know, put people away for long periods of time. And this particular day, they were doing just some motion hearings from attorneys and different court things and business. And they went through a lot of that. And finally, the judge finished with that, and he picks up a stack of papers off his desk, and he starts reading them. My son thinks to himself, oh, these are my traffic documents. And so he reads through them, and then he puts them down, and he looks out there, and he sees the officer sitting there, and he calls him up to the bench, and talking to him in hushed tones, and my son can see the officer nod a couple times, and in a little bit, the officer walks away, and he comes back to where my son's sitting, and he says, I'd like to see you out in the hallway. Okay. And so my son goes out in the hallway with this traffic cop, and immediately this cop says to him, says, you know, I've been a traffic officer for 8 years. I've never had a judge ask me to do what this one just asked me to do, and that is to take you downstairs before the commissioner and ask that your case be dismissed. And the officer says to him, who do you know? And my son looked at him. He says, well, I don't really know anybody, but I do know the law. And the officer, he said, had a very puzzled look on his face, and his son told him, he says, well, it's like this, officer. You had no authority to give me a traffic ticket. And he could tell the officer was kind of getting his hackles up now, and he wanted to come back and say something. He could tell it, but he didn't know what to say. So it's like somebody let the air out of him. He just kind of relaxes, and he says, okay, well, you're not going to go around running red lights, are you? And my son says, oh, no, that'd be irresponsible. That'd get somebody killed. I wouldn't do that. And he says, well, that's good to hear. So they get an elevator to go downstairs, and this traffic officer says to my son, says, you know, I've never had to do this before. I don't know how to ask a judge to dismiss a traffic ticket. And my son says to him, says, well, you seem like a nice guy. I'll help you out on this one. He says, just tell the judge that you want the ticket dismissed in the interest of justice.
And that's what happened, right?
And that's what happened. And
well, that's fantastic. It's time to come. You know, we have to close now.
Sure.
But I want to thank you for being with us, and I hope could you give people your site? It's
sure.
Ticketslayer.com, right?
Yes, uh-huh.
And I know that you're going to get a lot of traffic, and I hope that that not only did they learn how to use it for this, but that they see the many, many other applications.
Well, I have quite a bit of information on my site. If someone wants to go there and look around, if you have questions, my contact email's there on the site, and just feel free to contact me. I'd be happy to answer any of your questions.
That's going to be, and I know that you'll hear from a lot of people. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, my pleasure, Melinda. Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, God bless.
Thank you. Right
Bye.
Back to you.
Yes. And that's our show for today, Friday, June 15, 2007. At The Spiritual Politician, we search for the deceits used to grab power and those always present sneak thieves of freedom that have clogged up our system like hair in the drain of life. On this show, as we do with all our shows, we end by reading the section of the Declaration of Independence that is America's mission statement. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evidences a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster coming to you from BBS Radio. God bless the journey that brings us to freedom, and may God be with you every step of the way. Good night.